Welcome to the Paul Spradley Show, a show dedicated to real strategies from real people practicing real leadership in diverse and inclusive cultures. And now here's your host, CEO of the diversity training firm, the Care-Based Leadership Collaborative, Dr. Paul David Spradley.
Hey, everybody, what's going on? Welcome to the show. You know what I was thinking about when I was driving over here is what would happen if we had an allotment of like car horns per week? Right? Like, if I only had three car honks a week, would we be more careful with who I honked with? Like, maybe, I don't know, I would say, honk, hey, Ricky, I saw you in the street, but now I don't have any more honks. I don't know, it's a weird thought. I'm just working through it right now. It's going to take some time to set in, but I'm sure that you're going to love the idea once we just start to rationalize car honks. I don't know. I'm talking crazy nonsense. But I'm very excited about my guest today because he knows a lot about being honked at. My guess is just because he's a stud. I'm sure he's been honked at a time or two. My guest is the Honorable Chardo Richardson, Jewish doctorate. He's a lawyer by trade. Chardo is a lifelong public servant, first serving our country in the United States Air Force, and then several government and advocacy stints, including the past president of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Central Florida, and a candidate of the House of Representatives. He's currently a board of directors for the brand new Congress. Chardo, welcome to the show.
Well, Dr. Spradley, thank you. That's a pretty awesome intro. thank you.
What's crazy about your intro, man, or your life, is that you have so much packed into. I mean, you're not very old, but you've done so much that I had to figure out what am I going to cut, because you're just an impressive guy, man. It's really, and so I want to dive right in if you're okay with that. So you're in politics, and tell me, how has being bald benefited you in politics? Because I have hair, and is it going to keep me from, will my chances be less if I have hair going into politics than if I don't?
So the easy question is, it saves time. So I'm all about efficiency, man. So if I don't have to do my hair in the morning, that's one bit that gives me a few more seconds or minutes to do something else. So
I appreciate that, man. you're very much into, so you're one of those people who have moved into a next echelon of leadership. So you're very, very meticulous about what you do. Tell me about who Chardo was when he was in high school. So before you were the person that you are now, like what was your transition sort of growing up like into this space, because then you went to the military, right? So like tell me about your early life and what were some of the things that happened that set you up to be, maybe a lifelong leader.
That's a great question. So the struggle, of course, you know, if you come from poverty, if you have to work hard for things, that is the best learning tool you have. You know, I was just listening to David and Goliath, an audiobook by Malcolm Gladwell, and he's talking about this wealthy individual who was raised in poverty and challenges, and he became this millionaire, and now his self-made millionaire, and now his struggle is, how is he going to teach his kids that? So, the struggle is real, and that's what really shapes and molds people. I'm not saying it's the only thing that can grow you into a great leader or teach you the lessons you need, humble you, those kinds of things. But it is a really good source of inspiration, if you will, or motivation. But my early life, I was born in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast. And then what a lot of people don't know about me is I've been a leader my whole life. So I'm the oldest of about 25 grandkids. I'm the oldest male. Many of my aunts, I have six aunts and two uncles, but many of them were single moms. So me being the oldest, we all lived very close to each other. I was always leading and basically motivating and a big brother to all of my male cousins, which I look back on it now. You can't connect the dots going forward, but you can connect them going back. That was kind of like the proving ground, right? The young Chardo leading, you know, these riffraff boys who didn't have a father. So that was like the start of it, the youth. And then I also, what folks don't know about me is I was on radio shows early on, with a very close friend of mine. His mother was a advocate in, during the 60s, and she had a radio show, so she would bring he and I and a couple of our other young friends on. We were in the 15, 16 age range. Bring us on the weekends to talk about social justice issues. So really, I grew up with the ability to debate and argue. It just, my life just naturally started to progress that way. I did later in life, like in high school, you know, I was always a smart kid, but I didn't do much. So I did a lot, I got a lot of C's because I wouldn't do homework, I wouldn't study, that kind of stuff.
And C's get degrees, man. I don't know, just being honest here.
I'm very careful with what I tell my daughters nowadays. But yeah, that's the early life.
You talked about your social justice at an early age. Like, what kinds of conversations were you having around social justice? Because I had two series of questions that are like, man, do I go this way or this way? Because I'm also curious if you just started naturally taking on leadership roles. So you were leading out your cousins and whatnot, but then did you also find yourself gravitating towards leadership in school, leadership on athletic teams, leadership in these different spaces, and just it became a natural thing for you? And is that kind of where your voice was developed, especially around this space for social justice issues?
Yes, exactly. You got it. So when we were on the radio shows, we talk a lot about race. Mississippi was and still is, for the most part, at least to my understanding, a very racially tense place in some areas. And we lived in those areas. So my friend's mother would bring us on. We talk about race a lot. We talk about, you know, the culture at that time. This is the early 90s. Whatever she could pull out of us that was something to inform her listeners was what we talked about. But yes, looking back, I don't know if I gravitated towards it. I can tell you that my grandmother was very influential in my upbringing. And one of the things that she would just drill into my head, these great sayings, and I've shared a couple with my daughters, but she would always say, you can be a leader or a follower. You decide what you want to be. And that stuck with me. And I use it with my daughters now. And I tell them, you know, you have the choice. You can be a leader or a follower. But it's important to understand as a leader, you must be a follower better than anybody else, because you're going to lead people who are going to follow you. And if you don't know what they've gone through, if you don't know what that difficulty is in following a leader, you're doing your followers a disservice. So I would tell anybody who wants to be a great leader, first learn to follow like nobody's business. I mean, in essence, salute smartly whenever you're given orders, and then you'll become a great leader.
Which sounds like a great transition into your time into the military, right? So some of these skill sets you already had developed, it sounds like you deepened those a little bit more when you went and served in the United States Air Force. And then you were an instructor in the Air Force as well, too. So talk a little bit about that experience. And then I want to jump into politics after that.
Yeah, sure. So the funny part about that, and it's a good segue, because it was this gravitational thing. When I went to basic training, I was selected as an element leader. So you have your tiered, you know, your chain of command, if you will. You have the TI, which is the training instructor, the guy who has the big hat, gal who has the big hat who yells in your face. And then below that, you have a dorm chief, which is amongst the recruits. Usually it's an older person. You know, you have male bay or all male units and all female units. So we had a he was a football player, college football player, center actually, and he was the dorm chief. And then below that, you had four element leaders. Funny enough, I was selected as an element leader within the first few days of the of arriving at basic training when they originally shaved my head. So I led from there, and it never stopped. I mean, even in the Air Force, I was air crew, so we flew on the KC-10s. I was a boom operator, and I was always in different spaces and different countries and flying a lot. But even at that young age, a brand new baby boom, as they called us, you know, the commander would put me in charge of lieutenants or, and it's not necessarily in charge, but we had, for example, we had a fitness program and I was pretty into fitness. I was only about 22 years old and the fitness program needed to be revamped in our squadron. So the commander put me in charge of that. And on that team of leaders within that group, I had some lieutenants, some sergeants, a couple of airmen, that kind of thing. And I was just a lowly airman myself with two stripes. So I think that you see it in a person. You know when you see a leader, you know when you see someone who's got the abilities to accomplish the task you want and or what you need done. And I am fortunate that individuals can see that in me and provide me the opportunities. And it's not any different from what happened with the ACLU. I went to my first meeting at the ACLU back in 2015, I want to say. And within the first meeting, this lady named Rita, she's in her 80s, been arrested more times than you can count. Yeah. She protests at prisons. You know, she's a staunch advocate for human rights and civil rights. And I remember sitting at that meeting, not knowing anybody. And the president at the time said, you know, I got to step down. So what you guys want? And she looks at me and goes, give it to him. And that was people.
Wow. So maybe the life lessons that you learned from Rita, for instance, I one of the things that I appreciate that I'm going to kind of tease out a little bit because you've mm-hmm. kind of, you've said some things over the course of your life that are starting to now line up as a pattern. And one of the things that I think that I'm seeing is that the fact that you are seeing people, right? So you talk about this in how you communicate leadership to your girls. You talk about this when you were growing up. You said, like, there's a struggle space, and you have to understand that people are coming from a struggle space. And now, even as you tell the story about, you know, the woman Rita, you saw who she was and her backstory. And so that has to be, so you're a lawyer by trade, and you started the company Think Legalese, and a lot of this was around helping people, A, understand legal terms, but this gift that you have is seeing people, right? Like seeing their backstory and being able to connect with them. And I think, would you say that that's been a contributor to your success in law and in politics, is your capacity to really connect and see people for who they are?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for those kind words. Absolutely. You have to see people. And when you say see people, I think of compassion. When you start from a place of compassion and humility, you can't go wrong. I mean, right. I think we've gotten it backwards as time. I think we're getting it right now with what you see folks, you know, taking a big interest in what's called emotional intelligence and the table aren't necessarily the skills that we were raised with or Generation Xers or baby boomers to be this leader who just barks orders from the front or from the back. You're seeing now the skills transition into people skills and really understanding them. And that's not to say that we didn't have baby boomers and CEOs right now of the older generation that don't get that. They were just ahead of their time. But I think as we go, yeah, it becomes more about people. You cannot lead someone if you can't understand where they're coming from. If you don't know, you don't need to know the intricacies of their job or what they need to do to accomplish every little step. For example, a crane operator, you don't need to know those things, how to operate a crane in order to lead a crane operator. But what you do need to know is what that crane operator has to do every single day to operate that crane. And you need to have a firm respect for it. And from understanding that space, understanding how much that person makes as far as what they're trading their time for money for, will give you an appreciation on how to talk to them and, of course, or how to lead them. And, of course, you still have to talk to them and communicate with them. So yeah, it comes down to people, man. It's all about people. When you have compassion and you understand, you can do anything. Even the angry person, you know, I rode a bus. Quick story. I rode a bus while I was in law school. I got out of the military in 2012 and said, I'm going to law school, got in, got a partial scholarship, and didn't make wise decisions in the military. So I didn't save money or anything like that. I had a little bit of money left to my name and I just up and did it, you know, and didn't have a vehicle. So the first year and a half, and it only took me 2 years for law school, but the first year and a half, I had to ride a bus, the public transportation, and it's like your grandpa's story.
Yeah.
2 hours to school both ways, kind of
uphill.
Thing. Uphill. Yep. Uphill, yeah. But we had a bus driver on that route. There was a driver, and he always had like a bad attitude. And I would talk to him every time I got on, have my headphones on, take them off, say hello, read my books and courses for study. And he was a lot more kind. He was kinder to me than I saw other. He was to other people. That doesn't mean he was great to me, but understanding his struggle, you know, he's not making a ton of money. He's driving a bus all day with people who are treating him poorly. But if you can get in that space with him, you can really understand his struggle. But it's compassion, Dr. Spradley. It's compassion.
That's fantastic, man. And I kind of want to move into a similar but slightly different space. So you're saying it's all about people. It's about being compassionate. We are, this is an election year, and you know, Florida has continued, you live in Florida now. Florida is continually one of the most important states that a president or presidential candidate needs to win. And Florida is incredibly diverse, right? Like there's a thriving senior population that comes down, they call them snowbirds, that have residence in Florida. Florida has a large Latino, Latinx population. Florida has a large African-American population. Florida has, and because it's a coastal place, you know, you have refugees, you have immigrants coming in from different places. Talk to me about what that means for political figures to have any influence or be effective in the state of Florida.
So that's, you got a good grasp of it, brother. That's for sure it. To be successful in politics in Florida, you really have to play the game. Whether you like it or not, it's politics. I think you should always maintain your morality. We didn't take any corporate money, and we just decided not to do that. However, the incumbent had close to $3 million. So the chances of winning are very slim because you can't get your name out if you ain't got the money. But
right.
I would say to win in politics in Florida, you really gotta, you put the leather on the pavement, get to the doors, make the phone calls. You just have to really make it a significant priority. And with that, having a strong platform that people can support. One thing about Florida that you didn't mention, not because you're not well versed in it, I just want to make sure that this is on the table and we are talking about, is Amendment 4 and voter suppression.
Voter suppression
has been serious to me.
Tell me about it. What is Amendment 4 for those folks who don't know what it is?
Yeah. So Amendment 4 last year was an amendment to our Constitution here in Florida. It's got a lot of work from a lot of people. Amendment 4 was a restoration of voting rights for our disenfranchised individuals, turning citizens to the community, folks who committed felonies and they lose their right to vote, and precious right of voting and having your voice heard. So you have a father who made stupid decisions in his youth, like many of us do, just so it happens he got caught and he's got a felony for whatever reason. Well, now he's raising children and he can't even vote on who's going to be on their school board making decisions about their education. Mm. That's just wrong on so many levels, and it's un-American, in my opinion. So Amendment 4 was passed last year through the tireless efforts of so many individuals. I worked on it before I started running for U.S. Congress. I didn't use it during my campaign because I did not want to make it a partisan issue. I knew how valuable it was. But Desmond Meade, if you do a search on Google, he and I were very, he more so than I had an impact because he was basically on the forefront, but it was basically a supporting role we played at the ACLU. But amendment disenfranchised individuals the ability to vote. So the legislature, or excuse me, the people voted, passed by a majority, a significant majority, and say, you know what, you should be able to vote after you've served your sentence, after you've served your parole, after you've done what you needed to do, you should be able to vote. Well, our legislature here in Florida decided to pass a bill that requires these individuals to pay back all of their court fines, everything that has ever, every penalty that's been levied against them. Now, in essence, there's two sides to this. Is that wrong? Not inherently, right? We want people to be, to make the victims whole if they were committed a burglary or something like that. We want them to make the victims whole through monetary means. Right. However, what it does in actuality is, it says, if you're a felon and you've done all your physical requirements, but you haven't paid back all the restitution or the court fees, then you can't vote. But if you're a felon who just by chance so happens to get a good job out of prison and so happens to get people to give you breaks a couple times and you can afford to pay all those fines, then you can vote. Wow. And that is, in essence, giving folks with money the power to vote, while our individuals who don't have that means, you're not getting your right back. And that's the hard part for me to swallow.
With it. And it's hard to swallow because of the power dynamic. Is that what you're, is that really the at the root of it for you, is this idea that if you have capital, if you have influence, if you have money, if you have status, that you are afforded certain unalienable rights that you don't get? Can you hear me, Chardo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. You hit it on the head. That's what bothers me about it. Well, looks like we got a poor connection.
Chart, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Can you hear me? I can hear you.
I can hear you now. I can hear you now. You're perfectly clear. You froze for a second.
Oh, sorry about that.
Okay.
No, I was saying your recap is absolutely correct. Okay. Yes, that is how I feel about it. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. There are people who will choose not to vote. What is your thoughts on that? I mean, it's people's rights to vote. We got about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about this because this is something that's really everyone knows that voting is important, but some people will choose not to, and that's important, especially in states like Florida. What are your thoughts on that?
So it's really important to vote. You've hit it on the head, though. You can't. Hopefully, you can still hear me.
Yep, we can hear you.
You can't force someone to vote. And we have to educate people on the necessity of voting. And that's ties into that understanding people and being compassionate, you know? So you can't force people to vote. I've sat in rooms with individuals who are returning citizens, and they've in no uncertain terms told me they don't want to vote. They don't feel like it helps them. And I respect that. I respect that only because this is a person you've turned away for so long. And now you're saying you're trying to get them to participate in the process. So I do agree that it's absolutely important for everyone to vote. It starts early. You have to teach these folks how to vote early, what voting is. Take your kids with you to the polls. Take your kids and sit down with them when you're voting by mail and show them how you do it. We got to make it a culture to get this right, you know? And we have to understand that people aren't going to want to vote. If I live in a household, say I live with my older mother and father, and my father is a disenfranchised individual who can't vote, and I have the mindset of, I do what my family does, and my father can't vote, I'm not voting. It hurts him, I'm not going to do it. He probably wouldn't allow me to do that. But I'm just saying there's a reason why people don't want to vote. I think it comes down to education.
If I am listening to this show right now and I'm liking what I'm hearing and I think I might want to move into politics or at least be more active politically, because that's one of the other things that I'm hearing, right? There's people saying, I won't touch politics at all because it's divisive. And so I won't touch it all. I want to lean in because I feel like it has value, but I just need someone to convince me that I should do that. What would you say to that person?
You don't have to be on the forefront in politics. I was never on the forefront in politics until I was approached by brand new Congress. But I was always in the background. I was always working on bills with my teams and addressing injustice and rubbing shoulders with politicians and lobbying politicians. But you don't have to be on the forefront. People don't have to know your politics if you are uncomfortable with that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you are motivated to participate in the process, there's plenty of ways to do that. You can do it as small as just writing letters. If you just sit and write letters, you can do that. There's so much room and space in that area that you don't have to be on the forefront. You don't have to be decisive. You don't have to put it on your social media what you're doing. If you want to get involved and you want to volunteer, you can head over to brandnewcongress.org. And we are always looking for volunteers.
Brandnewcongress.org. Got it. We're going to put that in our show notes.
No, brandnewcongress.org. We are a nonprofit. We work with volunteers across the spectrum. We're nonpartisan. Our executive directors are Republican. Many of our board members are Democrats. Some are independents. The candidates we run Republicans, we run Democrats, we run independents. We've got three young ladies running for U.S. Senate this year, one that I ran with in 2018, Pauline Swearengen, who's in West Virginia, and she's really trying to change. We've got a number of candidates running for the House, including Cori Bush out in Missouri, who was on the front lines of Missouri and Ferguson. We've got Anthony Clark in Illinois. There's just a ton of them. And we've got some candidates coming this year that also, you know, we ran with Alex, Representative Ocasio-Cortez. She was our running mate. Yeah. And we're trying to get a couple more of her in this cycle as well.
Charter, that is all the time we have for today, man. Can you really quickly tell us where folks can find you on social media if they want to connect with you?
So I don't do a lot of social media, but if you go to Twitter, you can go to The Real Chardo, at The Real Chardo. And then I also have a Facebook. I have an Instagram. My time is so limited. I don't have as much time to stay on the person and share with you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate you being on the show. That's our time. Listen, visit my website, www.carebasedleadership.org. Let's sit down for a free consultation on how we can work through your diversity and inclusion challenges. Until next time, keep on caring.